The Guardian.
Hello, you have landed on Planet Science Weekly. Welcome. I'm Camilla Ruse, and joining us this week...
I don't like the word determined, actually, but when it comes to sex, I think one can really use that because it's part of natural selection's grand design.
Ahead of her appearance at this year's How the Lights Get In Festival, Darwinian philosopher Helena Cronin will be discussing her work in evolutionary psychology. And...
they're so much more efficient because they don't need the food that they ingest to produce heat because they're cold-blooded. A cow uses a lot of the energy that it gets in to keep the whole body warm.
Professor of Entomology Marcel Dick tells us why a fly in your soup is not such a bad thing and how protein from insects could be the answer to the world's rising food demands. Also, we'll be taking a look at some of this week's science news stories, including the fight to save the honeybee and why the aquatic ape theory is back on the news. Joining me to discuss these stories will be two titans of the science comedy troupe Festival of the Spoken Nerd, Helen Arney and Steve Mould. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. The festival season is looming, but between all the rock and pop festivals, there is the Glastonbury of ideas. That's the How the Lights Get In festival at Hay-on-Wye here in the UK. One of the many debates at the festival that caught our eye was an event on sexuality after genetics. It's a discussion about the nature of gender and sex differences in light of the science of epigenetics. A key speaker on the panel is the Darwinian philosopher and author Dr. Helena Cronin. Helena is co-director of the Centre for Philosophy of Natural and Social Science at the London School of Economics, and she came into the studio to tell me about the debate. So I asked Helena to explain the title, What is Sexuality After Genetics?
It's the idea that there's a conflict between those who believe that gender is socially constructed and those who say that it's biologically constructed or biologically determined.
I'm guessing you're on the latter side.
I'm very much on the latter side, yes. After all, it's natural selection what did it, and natural selection doesn't work through culture in that way.
So why don't we talk a little bit about the argument then? What is the controversy?
The controversy, I think, stems from people fundamentally who don't like the idea of genes because they feel that's deterministic and they feel that we have free will and we can make choices. So that's the very fundamental idea. Within that, there are different kinds of reasons for objecting to the idea that sexuality is basically biological and not cultural. And one is, I think you find that more among feminists and lesbians than you do among males. And possibly the reason for that is that it is more malleable. Sexuality, sexual orientation is more malleable in females than males, in that females are much more likely than males to switch in and out of being of homosexuality, out of attraction to the same sex. Males tend to stick with it once they've chosen it.
Okay, so why don't we talk about the kind of differences between the sexes that are biologically determined?
Right. I don't like the word determined, actually, but when it comes to sex, I think one can really use that because it's part of natural selection's grand design. And it's one of the most high-tech and brilliant things that natural selection did, which was to invent sexual reproduction. Reproduction by means of two sexes in particular, which is what most large organisms do. And that was about 800 million years ago that's been going, so it's had a lot of time to refine it. And if you think of it this way, I think this can help to see why we have males and females being the way they are, right down the generations till today. If you're just cloning yourself, you just plod along and you make more of yourself and you bud off and so on. But once you get into sexual reproduction, you have to divide your reproductive effort into two parts: competing for mates and caring for offspring. Now, from the very beginning of the invention of sexual reproduction, 800 million years ago, one sex specialized slightly more in competing and the other specialized slightly more in caring. And by the simple logic of natural selection down the generations, once you are specializing more in one, that's the one you'll concentrate on getting better at and doing more of and doing better than the next person. And so eventually you'll get increasing divergence between the two sexes, and one sex will devote itself far much more to competing for mates and the other to caring for offspring. And I don't need to tell you which is which all these generations later. And especially in mammals, as we are, the females are very much committed to caring for offspring, much more. It's not an optional thing, it's an obligate caring. And the males, therefore, they're all the more value to the males because it's a precious resource that females have. They put so much care into it that the males scramble and compete even more for the females.
Why don't we go back to the genetic differences that you were talking about? The, and you don't like the word determined, but biologically determined, biologically influenced differences.
Good, yes.
That's better. Could you give me some more examples? What other things are we talking about?
You mean in sex differences?
Yes.
Yes, okay. Well, I've sometimes divided them into four T's. That's talents, taste, temperaments, and tails. I think talents, you can see, that speaks for itself. For example, maths, engineering, and so on. And that's largely because of this ability to do three-dimensional mental rotation. Tastes and temperaments, they're very much to do with what interests you and how single-minded you are about it and how much you care about other things in life. So with all of those things, I would say that you can put it as men and women, on average, and we're only talking about averages here, on average, have different life priorities. But the fourth T, which I've called tails, that's a very different one. What I mean by the tails is the ends of these statistical curves, the extreme right-hand end or the extreme left-hand end. And it's a fact of biological life that males, not just in our species, but in all sexually reproducing species where there are these sex differences, evolved sex differences, the males, there's greater male variance than female variance. That is, in males, the difference between the largest and the smallest, the best and the worst, the least and the most, is much greater than it is in females. Females tend to cluster around the average, cluster around the mean much more. But in males, you get this much bigger spread. And I think that's an extremely significant difference between males and females that is underrated because it actually skews our understanding of males and female differences unless we take that into account. Unfortunately, people tend generally just to look at the means and they don't look at the variance. So they look at the fact that on average, girls are as good as boys, and then they wonder why it is that boys just shoot up the scale at university and get the firsts and then go on and get the PhDs and so on, whereas girls don't, and they don't realize that there was always that right end of the tail where there were largely or only males. But we must remember for males also, there are usually a lot of males at the other end as well, at the left-hand end of the curve. So in general, I've summed it up as, among males, there are more no-bells, but there are more dumbbells too.
So can we talk a little bit about, going back to your talk, and it says that you're going to discuss how gender can be changed by genetics. What does that mean, by lifestyle?
I think that when people refer to that, one thing that they can be referring to is this notion of epigenetics, which is very fashionable at the moment. Epigenetics is the idea that epi, around the gene, it's not exactly what genes do is the idea. It's something that happens around the genes. And this is seen as, unfortunately, it's flaunted as a revival of Lamarckism. Remember that Lamarck was famous for saying that you can inherit acquired characteristics. So famously, the giraffe stretches its neck to reach the higher leaves, and its offspring are born with longer necks. the blacksmith grows great muscles during his lifetime, and so his sons, presumably not, let's hope not his daughters, are born with the same sorts of muscles and develop the same sorts of muscles. So the idea is, although they've only acquired it during their lifetime, so it's something we think hasn't changed the genetic makeup at all, and therefore shouldn't be inherited, these things are inherited. That was Lamarckian theory, and it's been thoroughly discredited for several centuries, but there's a fashion now for reviving it by pointing to this science of epigenetics and saying, well, that's really Lamarckian. The simple answer is, there is a science of epigenetics. It's a straightforward Darwinian science, and it's not in the least Lamarckian. All it's doing is saying the following. Think of it this way. The whole point of genes is to respond to the environment, to take resources from the environment in order to build organisms and to enable them to flourish and to reproduce. The famous mathematician Paul Erdős said, I'm just a machine for turning coffee into theorems. I always like that because it reminds me very much of what genes do. Genes are machines for turning the world's resources into more genes. And they do that by building organisms who have all these glorious adaptations. Genes build these adaptations, like striking beautiful tails that males have, and eggs, which are a wonderful adaptation. Everything from eyesight to limbs to petals to pollen and so on. These are all adaptations. These are all things that genes have made by latching onto the world's resources and turning them into these splendid, splendid adaptations that organisms, that typify living things. And one of the ways that the genes can respond to the environment is not by changing the genes, not by a mutation, but by switching themselves on and off. And we know that that happens, and we know that that's because of environmental cues. When we talk about environment here, many of those environmental cues come from the body itself, particularly for an embryo. During the time it's developing, its genes switch on and off in response to what's happened before. So development is a response to the environment that's just been created, and that creates new initial conditions, and the embryo responds to those, and the genes respond to those. So genes can respond to also to outside aspects of the environment, as to whether it's cold or not. In reptiles, sex can be determined by temperature. And all that epigenetics is the finding that our genes respond in more ways to the environment than had been previously thought. And very often, those effects do go on into the next generation for good reasons. But these are just Darwinian adaptations that are done in that way.
So what about the effects they can have on gender then, the switching on and off of the genes?
Right. Embryos are determined as males or females after about 12 weeks of gestation. Hormones come in and start to shape the embryo, and it shapes them into males or females. And that's not just sex organs, but it's the brain and the psychology, including sexual orientation and sexual preference. Now, we know from identical twins, identical male twins, let's just talk about males, we know from identical male twins that it is the case that sometimes one of them is, so to speak, born with homosexual preference, and the other is not. So, and yet they've got exactly the same genes. So the idea is, presumably, somewhere along the line, when the hormones were shaping that male as a male, including standard male preference for females, it shaped the other one differently with a preference for males. We don't know how the hormones work in those cases. It isn't yet known, but that's a very nice example of where you've got same genes, but a different outcome, but possibly through hormonal action in the embryo, and the embryo genes in the embryo responding differently to them, or more likely because the level of the hormone is different, the timing is slightly different, or something very subtle like that.
Epigenetics and this switching of the genes on and off and how it affects gender differences, and as you were saying, the hormones have such a big impact on things. Where is the future of this research going? You know, what are they going to find next?
The future findings of sex differences, there's a lot that's still open. For one thing, there's a war, genes against genes, inside bodies. Most genes inside a body, in sexually reproducing organisms in particular, are highly cooperative with one another because they've got a common interest in getting that body to mate successfully so that they can get themselves out into the next generation. So they have a lot of common interests, but some interests they don't have in common because, for example, and this is a very interesting area that I think is going to show us all sorts of new things that we hadn't known about. For example, the interests of the genes from the father often conflict with the genes that come from the mother. And so a conflict in those genes can produce a war, as it were, within the embryo.
What do you mean by conflict?
The conflict is, for example, imagine a female, imagine a species in which the females aren't absolutely perfectly monogamous, even though it's called a monogamous species. That is, every species that has ever existed is of that kind. The males don't have a guarantee anyway that the female will be absolutely monogamous. Now, for the female, any child that she has is only part of her general reproductive effort, so she doesn't want to go all out putting her very last bit of energy into any particular child. For a male, particularly in species where there isn't monogamy and the male is mating with the female perhaps just for that one time and is then going off to mate with others, he wants that offspring to take as much of the resources and energy from the mother as it possibly can. And so the genes in the female have a way of switching off the genes in the male generally, but the genes in the male can fight back under experimental conditions, as has been done. And under those conditions, you do indeed get huge embryos, and they're not usually viable.
Interesting. So is that research, and what species are we talking about?
The work has been done on mice, and they certainly have found exactly as predicted theoretically, given a selfish gene, a gene-centered point of view, predicted theoretically that could happen, but nobody thought until, say, 20 years ago, that genes could, quote, recognize where they came from, whether they came from a father or a mother. We now know that under certain conditions they can. Now, those are sometimes called epigenetic effects, and they're actually seen as an anti-gene-centered view. On the contrary, as I say, when you've got a really gene-centered view and you understand that genes are selfishly replicating themselves down the generations, that's an obvious thing that they could do. And lo and behold, we found they do it.
A huge thanks to Dr. Helena Cronin there. For more information on the festival, go to howthelightsgetin, all one word, .com. Or you can follow the links on our blog, guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. Helena's session is on at 4 p.m. on Friday the 31st of May. Now it's time for us to look at some of this week's science news. I'm joined by two-thirds of the science-infused comedy trio, Festival of the Spoken Nerd. Helen Arney and Steve Mould, well, welcome back to the podcast, because you've both been here before, haven't you?
Yes.
We have, yep.
Okay, well, in that case, let's kick off with a story. Steve, do you want to go?
Yes, so the story I want to talk about is scientists have been experimenting on mice, as is their want.
Habit.
Yes.
That's not news, is it?
No,
that's
big
really
news.
Old news.
In this case, they've been looking at the mice's hypothalamus, and it seems like that there's a process inside the hypothalamus, it's a tiny part of their brain, that they can influence this process and change the lifespan of these mice. So they can increase the lifespan of these mice by something like 15% by altering the way this hypothalamus operates. And the interesting thing about this story, I think, is that it looks as though aging is something that is controlled. There is our bodies or our brains have control over aging in some way. So aging isn't like a disused building slowly decaying. It's more like, you know, the Severn Bridge. So the Severn Bridge is constantly being painted to make it nice and shiny and new. And maybe there's a control mechanism that says, okay, stop painting the bridge now, or don't paint it as well, or something like that. So eventually that renewal process is turned off, but it's done in a controlled way. The mice aren't living for longer in old age. Their youth is being prolonged. So they're living a more youthful and longer life. And so if I could live forever, you know, essentially as a 25-year-old, then yes. I mean, like the
Who
question,
would say no?
The question becomes, when do you want to die? You know, like if you were perennially 25 years old and you don't want to live forever, then how do you choose? When do you pop your clogs? When do you make that choice?
It's a really good question. I don't know, because if your youth is continued, and I think the thing with these mice is that they don't get muscle weakness, they don't have memory problems or anything like that, so they're just young for longer.
Forever. Well, yeah, but which, forever if we
unless
you know,
a scientist comes in and jams them with something else.
But
I don't know. There's an argument for, like, you need to reach a certain level of maturity, and I think you need a certain part of your life where you're not a 25-year-old, where you're not able to do the things that you used to be able to do, and with that comes wisdom and maturity. And you know, our lives as they are couldn't cope with suddenly having an extended kind of youthful period. I think our lives as they are, we would suddenly find it really difficult if we all lived to 120, not just resource-wise and not just kind of social-wise, as in it would be only people who could afford this who would be able to live longer. But I just think we wouldn't. It would turn into anarchy.
Well, this is the moral case, isn't it? That is it fair? Will we run out of resources? And actually, if we had a magic switch that we could turn on and suddenly everyone's going to live forever, there is obviously a very powerful argument for not flicking that switch. But it's, of course, it's not going to happen that way. It's going to happen very, very slowly. You know, the sort of the stated reason for this research in mice is to try and cure age-related disease. And so that will be the first thing. And of course, no one's arguing against trying to cure Parkinson's disease.
Or Alzheimer's.
Or Alzheimer's disease or cancer or whatever, right? And so this is something that will happen very, very slowly. And this is why I think it's a great story, because it does present these challenges. On the one hand, you think, look, let's just not do this because this is a terrible idea, right? But on the other hand, look, it's going to happen. So how will we cope with it? You know, what are we going to do?
But what are we going to worry about then? That's what will it be at that point? What will we be concerned about?
Well, at that point, our probability of dying follows a Poisson distribution, which is the same as like the probability of a radioactive decay, right? So if you are lucky enough to live for 1 million years, at that point, your probability of dying is the same as someone who's 10 minutes old, right? So because you're just going to, because the only way you die in this future scenario, which may not happen, but fingers crossed, is by accident, right? Or by murder or whatever. So it becomes like a probabilistic thing as opposed to an inevitable thing.
Right. So why don't we move on now that we've covered living forever to the bees. Helen, I think that's yours.
Yes, the bees, the bees. Oh, the bees.
This you suffered a bit with this bee story.
Yeah, as in, it, you know, partly it seems so clear cut and it's something that a lot of people have got involved in as activists. 2.6 million people signed a petition to the UK government to vote yes to banning three pesticides that are currently some of the most popular pesticides being used on crops in Europe. And this has just gone to a vote at the EU as to whether we should ban these three pesticides or not. They're three interrelated pesticides, and they're just three random things off the shelf. There are a certain type that was developed so it was less harmful to animals and mammals, humans, but still worked as a pesticide. So it's a very popular pesticide. The EU has kind of been divided between different countries, some of whom want to ban it and some of whom do not want to ban it. UK and Switzerland and a couple of Germany are ones that do not want to ban it. A lot of other countries in Europe do. Now, it just went to a vote, and I haven't quite got the hang of how the vote went, but I think it was basically, it was so close that in the end the EU had to decide themselves.
Yeah, I think that's
and
right.
They have decided to ban these pesticides. And this is part of an idea of trying to stop bees declining. That's what the reason for banning it was, which is a very interesting and complicated reason because there's a lot of things that are causing bees to decline. One of them is possibly pesticides, well, definitely some pesticides, and according to peer-reviewed literature, also but habitat loss, also their own sources of food, and everything to do with bees is basically in trouble at the moment. Bees are declining.
There are some diseases, aren't there, as well?
Yes.
There's a fungus, is it?
That's bee diseases.
I don't remember.
It's really sad, all this.
I know.
You know, this is why 2.6 million people signed the petition to get the UK government to vote yes to banning these pesticides. So people feel really passionately about bees. I mean, bees are great, right? We can all basically say that bees are great, and we all want more bees. We want bees to be safe, partly because they are part of the insect pollination, which affects about a third of our food is pollinated by insects. So, you know, they're incredibly useful. Their excretions taste delicious. They've got tessellating houses. They dance instead of using Google Maps. They can see in UV. Bees are amazing, right? They've got
you
hair
see them
and
do
knees.
The waggle dance.
They do the
it's
dance.
Amazing.
They go like, the bees are so brilliant.
They sting you.
Yeah,
you always have to put a downer on things.
Yeah, that's how you're not going to live forever, Steve.
I just want this. I want this to be a balanced argument. I'm joking.
But yeah, they only do it once, though. They never do it again. That's the problem. So
because they die afterwards.
Yeah.
They?
Oh, yeah. Bees. You know, it's everything's against the bees. EU member states have now got this continent-wide, it's only in Europe, suspension of these three pesticides, which I can't pronounce, but they
neonicotinoids, yeah.
Exactly.
As in nicotinoids, neonicotinoids, I think.
I love how you said
it
was
so much confidence.
That was really qualified.
We all believe you, so that's okay.
Someone is going to tell us at the bottom how to say it. So, but it's really difficult. The big question is, why did the UK vote not to ban them? They tried to vote against this ruling. And why did they, when 2.6 million people signed this petition, say they should? And that's what makes it so very complicated, because it's part of a bigger picture. It seems like the peer-reviewed literature does say that these pesticides do damage bees, but there isn't all that much research. And also, there isn't that much research in progress right now. So the arguments against banning it is like, oh, well, it might do something, but, you know, we need more research. But there's no research underway right now. So this I find such an extraordinary story, because we need crops as well. We need safe sources of food. And that's the biggest argument in favour of these pesticides, is that they are the most effective of a certain type. And to stop using them is possibly, hasn't been proved either way, obviously, detrimental to our crop production. And
so
no one wants the food supply to be damaged either. But this isn't a decision between, you know, should we stop smoking because it damages your health, which seems so kind of completely obvious, like, of course you should stop smoking because that damages your health. You know, it's very easy to say, oh, stop using pesticides because it damages bees, but you need pesticides to be able to
get the food.
So this isn't an obvious thing. It's like a two-way sort of sliding scale.
So what's the plan? If you can't use this pesticide, what do you do? You use older pesticides?
I think that's somewhat one of the things they're worried about, is that some of the older pesticides are worse than these I can't pronounce it either, so I'm just going to gloss over it.
Neonicotinoids.
Thank you. I should just give you a hand signal and then you say the word. So that's part of the worry, is that the older pesticides they're going to have to use as the alternative might be worse than the pesticides that they're banning.
Yeah. Right. And more damaging to other life forms as well, more damaging to mammals, more damaging to humans, more damaging to the crops that we are eating.
So which do you prefer?
Mammals or bees?
Okay, I think we better move on to another tough news story, which has been about aquatic apes. It's back on the news again, and it resurges every decade or so. Yeah. I'm not so sure if it resurges in the science, but it definitely does in the media. And this is the idea that humans, we all went through an aquatic phase in our evolution. So we were living beside big bodies of water or by the seashores, and that's the reason why we have certain parts of our anatomy. So we don't have fur because it was more efficient to not have fur when we live in water.
So we have a fat layer instead.
Exactly, yeah.
Well, thanks. Didn't come here to be an
I think the reason it's come back up again, the story, is because there's a conference next week, which is it's quite high profile. I think Sir David Attenborough is going to be there. Mm. And obviously, whenever Sir David Attenborough goes to some place, it becomes news. So back in the news again.
His local branch of Greggs must be like, we cannot wait for David Attenborough to come in, because we are going to put a press release about this.
Well, they probably could be able to.
Amazing. That would be awesome. And this story is so unprovable and delightful, because it is so far in our history that there isn't enough evidence either way.
And I think there just isn't any evidence at all for the aquatic ape. So apart from certain characteristics that they're saying. So I think I was reading some of them, and one of them is that we've got exceptionally large sinuses, so therefore they could have been buoyancy aids to help us keep our heads above water. I can see you sniggering in the corner.
It's mad, isn't it? Because by the time that kicks in, your head's below the water, isn't it? I don't know.
It's like an airbag. Yeah. It pops up when you hit water.
Because other animals, like seals and walruses, they have extra air sacs in their necks, which is what means they can beatbox. I've got some British Library recordings of a walrus beatboxing. It's absolutely
incredible.
You're
going to have to send them in now.
You can look them up. They're on the British Library website. There's a CD.
It's not intentionally beatboxing.
It's part of its kind of call.
Cool. Okay.
It's a very urban animal.
Yeah, it is. It produces incredible, like clicking sounds, because it travels really far underwater. And they have the airbags partly so they can fall asleep with their heads above the surface. But they've learnt to use them as these kind of huge resonating chambers. And there's on this recording, which you find on this British Library CD, it basically does this classic bit where it goes like doof, 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 which is really fun, right? And it goes doof, doof, and then it goes doo doo, tsh. Which is like it's just told a joke. It's absolutely brilliant.
We don't have those, unfortunately.
That's interesting, because animals that genuinely like can fall asleep with their heads above water have much more developed areas like that. You know, where are the remnants of our like beatboxing sacks?
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the evidence, or lack of, I have to say, for the theory. So, Steve, you were going to say something about.
Also, bipedalism. So the fact that we walk on two legs instead of four, that is very useful when you're wading through water, because you can wade more deeply, you can wade into deeper water. If you look at other apes, the only times they ever walk on two legs, it seems, is when they're wading through water. So if we were to find ourselves living in and around water, we probably would have developed bipedalism as a result. So it's definitely an explanation, which is great. But I suppose the point is there's a whole suite of human characteristics that can be explained. So we're much more streamlined in water if we don't have fur, so we lost our fur. In our brains, we've got bigger brains because of access to omega-3s, which is found in fish. So when we went through that aquatic stage, we were eating lots of fish, and so we could get these big brains in the same way that dolphins have got big brains because they've got access to it as well. A fatty layer to keep us warm because we lost our fur. In the same way that dolphins and whales have got a fatty layer.
And walruses.
And hippopotamuses. Hippopotamuses?
Hippopotami?
I don't give a shit.
Hippos.
What? Hippos.
Yeah, good.
Has anyone been looking at the Twitter feed?
No.
#SpaceApe.
No.
It was a good one. It was.
What?
I'm trying to find. I can't remember who did it, but somebody started the #SpaceApe, which was the same sort of train of thought that at least the aquatic ape theory could equally be used to say that we had a phase in space.
Oh, yeah.
So, for example, that we, we have big heads because our bodies are in space. We wouldn't need big bodies to support them.
Mm-hmm.
And when they started, and it was raging practically all week,
yeah,
the space age. And when you start thinking it, you look at it like that.
Yeah.
I don't know. It made me more and more skeptical, I think.
Seriously, yeah. Like, hairy bodies look less good in tinfoil space costumes.
True.
They really do. If you're going to do, like, a sort of space adventurer, sort of silver bikini thing, you don't want a hairy body for that.
It's true. Very good point. Oh, well, thank you both so much for coming in. Are you doing a festival at the moment?
We are part of the Udderbelly Festival down on the South Bank.
That's the big cow, isn't it, on South Bank?
The big upside-down purple cow on the South Bank. We're doing a show there every 3 weeks, and it's our Festival of the Spoken Nerd show, which is me and Helen and Matt Parker.
Who's missing today?
Yeah, he may be appearing as a bee at some point during the year.
Or is it series? Beatboxing walrus.
Beatboxing walrus. I'll do the beatboxing walrus. Matt can be a bee. So we're doing that, and that's us leading up to the Edinburgh Fringe as well. So anyone who is up in Edinburgh.
I'll be an immortal mouse, by the way.
Yeah. So you're
a what? An immortal mouse.
I'm the walrus, and this is turning into.
I am the walrus.
I
never thought that would ever be said just casually in a sentence without it being a reference to the Beatles. But anyway.
We are, as our immortal animal selves, we are heading up to the Edinburgh Fringe. So anyone who's in Edinburgh at any point in August can come and see our Festival of the Spoken Nerd there as well at Assembly.
Well, thank you very much. That's fantastic.
Thank you.
Now, another festival happening in May is the Wellcome Trust Who's the Pest season, a collaboration with Pestival, the annual celebration of insects. One of the events which took place here in London last week was called The Deliciousness of Insects. Entomologist and insect-eating ambassador Professor Marcel Dick was one of the main speakers, so I spoke to him from his native Holland ahead of the event and asked him what his culinary insect evenings are trying to achieve.
What I'm going to do is I'm going to convince the audience that the future of our dish will be that we're going to replace conventional meat gradually with insects, or at least they're going to supplement it. And my main message is that at this moment we have 7 billion people on this planet, and by 2050 the projections are that we'll have 9 billion. And the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations has calculated that in order to feed everyone by 2050, we'll need a 70% increase in food production. Now, at this very moment, of all the agricultural land that we have, 70% is being used to produce livestock, and 30% is being used to produce food. If we're going to increase by 70%, then obviously that's not going to happen with the amount of land that we use at this moment. And in fact, the land that we use at this moment for agriculture is very inefficiently used because we use 70% to produce livestock. That's really a very inefficient way of producing animal proteins, and animal proteins are a very important component of our diet. In order to increase that, we're not going to make that happen when we're going to continue eating what we eat at the moment. So we'll have to search for alternative animal proteins. And there's an excellent option there, and that is a group of organisms that at least in Europe and North America we have not eaten to any extent in the last decades or centuries, and that's insects.
So what kind of insects are we talking about? Are they grasshoppers, locusts?
Grasshoppers, locusts, mealworms, caterpillars, beetle larvae. There's a whole range of them that are being eaten. And
so there's something for everyone.
Definitely. Well, if you just consider this, in this part of the world, we're not eating them, but in other parts, they're a delicacy. And people really love them. They're not eating them because they're hungry, but because they're so delicious. In fact, we're just missing out something here. There's these delicate, delicious species that we could eat, but we don't do that at the moment. Well, a shrimp and a locust, if you compare them, the shrimp has a few more legs than a locust. The shrimp lives in the ocean and the locust lives on the land. Otherwise, they're taxonomically very related, and in terms of food quality, they're very related. In fact, there's cultures where they call locusts sky shrimps.
Why does the US and Europe not join in? What is it about insects that's putting us all off?
Well, I think for one thing, it's because insects are a more integrate component of cultures in the South. There's simply many more of them there. People have used to live with them. And in our part of the world, we've started to live, well, more and more in very clean conditions. Many people in the Netherlands, for instance, have no clue that they're in an environment where there's so many insects. But if you look at the calculations of the number of individual insects, then that's estimated to be of a number that's really beyond any grasp. But if you would translate that for every insect to be about a milligram, which it would be a small ant, then that would mean that there's for every person on this earth about 200 to 2,000 kilograms of insects. Insects are very abundantly present, but we in the West certainly consider them as something that we should avoid. We've always been taught by our parents that it is very natural for children, if they discover the world around them, to put everything in their mouth. When an insect would go in, at least my parents said, oh, come on, don't do that, yuck.
Is that how this all started?
Well, when I was a kid, this didn't start. It started about 15 years ago when my colleague Arnold van Huys, who is a tropical entomologist, he traveled through Africa and he was interviewing people on how insects were a part of their everyday life. And then he got to hear that there's a lot of people that eat insects. And he had lived there for quite a while, and then he didn't know that they were eating insects. And he found out why, because people in Africa wouldn't tell a white person that they are eating insects, because they knew exactly what kind of response they would get. They would get the response that they were retarded, that they did things that no one on earth should do, and they would be advised to stop this. Whereas for them, it was a delicacy, just like for us, eating an oyster, or in France, eating an escargot is just a delicacy.
So how do you change that food culture? Because I've seen scorpion lollies in some of the supermarkets, but they're novelty food items. So how do you go from that to something that's mainstream?
I think there are several ways. At least people have to be aware that insects are an excellent food source. And for one thing, well, we're eating honey, and the term honey is definitely something that has a very positive connotation. It's a product of insects. I'll tell people how important it is to do this in the future and start by right now, because they're delicious and we'll have to. But then how to make people do it, you have to make them taste that they're great. And that's what we're going to do tomorrow night and Wednesday night. We're going to tell people that these are delicacies, and that we're going to have people taste them. And so there's this restaurant in Copenhagen, Noma, the best restaurant in the world already for 3 years in a row. They put insects on the menu, especially because they see that insects are providing deliciousness to food. And so they'll make people taste it. And anyone that has tasted how good insects taste will have overcome a barrier, because I can easily understand that people do have barriers in eating insects, because we have been culturally educated that we should not do this. And so it takes a bit to overcome this. Well, we're eating sushi at the moment, and 10, 15 years ago, many people wouldn't think of eating raw fish. Now it has become, well, maybe not completely mainstream, but pretty close to that.
So can we talk a bit more about why insects as an alternative source of meat? So you said that the quality of their meat is comparable to what we have now. Is looking after them easier than it is other livestock? You know, what is it that makes them more environmentally friendly?
The most important thing why they're environmentally friendly is that they have a conversion factor that's much better than for cows or pigs. And with that I mean that if you give 10 kilogram of feed to a cow, you get 1 kilogram of cow out of that. And out of that 1 kilogram of cow, we eat about 50%. If we do the same thing with insects, if we take 10 kilogram of feed, we get about 7 kilogram of insects, and we eat about 85% of the insects. They're so much more efficient because they don't need the food that they ingest to produce heat because they're cold-blooded. A cow uses a lot of the energy that it gets in to keep the whole body warm. And so with the conversion factor from feed to cows is so bad that that's why we need this 70% of agricultural land to produce livestock. With insects, we don't have that problem.
So insects win all round. Now, I saw your TED talk, and you mentioned that there are many foods where we're already accidentally eating insects. Can you tell me about that?
Well, insects are abundant organisms on this planet, and they're everywhere. Finding a spot where there's no insects is almost impossible. And the same holds for food production. Our farmers try to produce food without insects, and they're pretty good at that, but not to the full 100%. Now, if you produce tomatoes and you sell them to the grocery store, then in the grocery store you get the best tomatoes that there are, all without any damage. But there's always some that have some kind of damage. They're not going to the grocery, but they go to the ketchup factory. And there they try to remove them as good as possible because they want to produce 100% tomato ketchup, but that's impossible. If you really would like to exclude any tomato that has a caterpillar in it or so, that would be impossible. The tomato ketchup price would skyrocket. So there's always a bit in there. The regulations on this are that ketchup, but for the same thing, any processed food can be safely produced and sold if they meet certain requirements, and that means that there's a certain limit of insect parts that can be in there. Now, if you use those standards, those limits, as a starting point, then you can calculate how much insect is in our food, and that's really in bread, in coffee, in ketchup, in applesauce, anything that's processed. And then we'll eat something like up to 500 grams of insects per year.
Per person?
Per person. In fact, as I told you, the quality is the same as beef, so in fact it's no problem. You eat tomato ketchup, well, if you put that on your hamburgers, then you already have a bit of extra meat there as well.
A little extra protein.
Right.
Many thanks to Professor Marcel Dick. To watch the video of his talk and to find out about the other events in the Wellcome Trust Who's the Pest season, including their final debate on who's a bigger pest, insects or humans, just go to their website. That's wellcomecollection.org/who's the pest. That's all we have for you in this week's show. Remember, for breaking science news day and night, go to guardian.co.uk/science. But from me, Camilla Ruse, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.